A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headaches.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. So Daniel sent us this one, and given where things are right now, the timing is striking. He's asking about the Israeli home front, specifically what military planners are actually thinking and doing as the ceasefire with Iran collapses in real time. The ceasefire expires on April 21st, which is Yom HaZikaron, Israel's Memorial Day. Independence Day falls the very next day. And yesterday there was what looks like a deliberate leak to Hebrew media, revealing that the IDF is at maximum preparedness, on full standby, specifically anticipating the possibility of a surprise attack. Meanwhile, Israeli municipalities are canceling Independence Day celebrations. Ordinary Israelis don't know what next week looks like, and the US just launched a naval blockade of Iranian ports this morning. Daniel wants to know, what are Israeli military planners actually thinking right now?
Herman Poppleberry here, and this is one of those episodes where the news cycle is moving faster than our ability to process it. The blockade took effect this morning at 10 a.m. Eastern. The Islamabad talks ended Sunday after 21 hours without an agreement, and the IDF has been placed on what sources are describing as a readiness protocol comparable to the days leading up to past campaigns against Iran. So we're not talking about elevated alert in the bureaucratic sense, we're talking about pre-campaign posture.
And by the way, today's script is coming from Claude Sonnet 4.6, which feels appropriate given that we're trying to make sense of a situation where the information environment itself is part of the strategy.
That's actually not a small point, because the leak itself is a major part of what's happening here. The JNS report from April 12th, citing anonymous military sources through INET, is unusually specific. Strike packages being assembled. Target banks in Iran being expanded, focused on missile systems and launchers. The Air Force rehearsing opening scenarios. Air defense being repositioned. Response times being shortened across all units. That level of operational detail doesn't end up in the Hebrew press by accident.
So walk me through the deliberate leak angle, because I think this is the most interesting thread. The IDF decides to tell the Israeli public, and by extension Iran, exactly how ready they are. What's the calculation there?
There are at least two audiences for that signal, and they're being told slightly different things. For the Israeli public, the message is, we are not caught flat-footed. After October 7th, the nightmare scenario for Israeli public confidence is a military that was surprised. Zamir's entire strategic doctrine since taking over as chief of staff has been explicitly built around the surprise war scenario. He said as much at a conference in January. The IDF is building a new strategy centered on never being in that position again. So when the ceasefire collapses and Israelis are looking at a week-long window of maximum uncertainty, the leak says, we saw this coming, we are ready, the switch can be flipped.
And for Iran?
For Iran, it's deterrent signaling. You're telling them, we have strike packages assembled, we have target banks expanded, we have opening scenarios rehearsed. The implicit message is that resuming hostilities is going to cost you immediately and severely. The hope is that this raises the threshold for Iran to do something provocative during the ceasefire window or immediately after it expires.
But here's the tension I keep coming back to. If you signal that you're ready to strike, doesn't that also tell Iran the strike is coming? Doesn't that actually increase the incentive to preempt?
This is the genuine strategic dilemma, and I don't think there's a clean answer. The traditional Israeli approach has been to maintain ambiguity. You don't tell adversaries exactly what you're planning. But there's a school of thought, and I think Zamir represents it, that in a situation where the adversary already assumes you're preparing to strike, the deterrence value of transparency outweighs the operational cost. You're not revealing anything Iran doesn't already assume. What you're doing is making the cost calculation clearer. The question is whether Iran's leadership, which is under enormous pressure right now, processes that signal rationally.
And that's not guaranteed.
Not remotely. There's a reason the senior Israeli security official who briefed in late March was worried about mines in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has asymmetric options that don't require a direct missile exchange. They've already shown that. And with a U.S. naval blockade now in effect, the pressure on Tehran to do something, anything, to demonstrate they haven't been completely defanged is significant.
Let's talk about what the IDF has actually accomplished, because I think context matters here. The numbers from the March 27th briefing are extraordinary. 8,500 strikes in Iran since late February. 400 ballistic missiles destroyed. 335 missile launchers. Roughly 70% of Iran's overall launcher arsenal. That's a significant degradation.
It's significant, but the senior Israeli official who gave those numbers in the same breath said the IDF needs a few more weeks to finish the job. Which tells you something important, 70% is not enough. You can do a lot of damage with 30% of a large missile arsenal, and the remaining capability is presumably the hardened, dispersed, and concealed portion, the stuff that survived 8,500 strikes. That's not the easy targets. That's the stuff Iran protected most carefully.
And then there's the uranium problem, which Netanyahu put on television on Saturday night.
Which is the unresolved core of this entire conflict. Netanyahu said it plainly, there is still enriched material in Iran. It needs to be removed, either by agreement or other ways. A senior Israeli official told ABC News explicitly that it is not possible to seize Iran's enriched uranium by military force. The phrasing was pointed, U.S. Marine expeditionary units don't have the engineering tools to extract material from underground sites. So what Netanyahu means by other ways is genuinely unclear, and that ambiguity is not accidental.
It's also the reason a lasting ceasefire deal is structurally almost impossible to reach. If Iran won't give up the uranium and Israel won't accept a deal that leaves it in place, there's no obvious landing zone.
Which is exactly why the Islamabad talks failed. 21 hours of negotiations and no agreement. The fundamental incompatibility isn't about the terms of a ceasefire, it's about the end state. Iran's nuclear program is the reason this war started. You can't paper over that with a 2-week pause.
I want to go back to the home front piece, because I think it's easy to get absorbed in the military strategic layer and lose sight of what this actually looks like for people living in Israel right now. The Independence Day cancellations are a striking signal.
They're a real barometer of national mood. You have the mayor of Ashkelon saying they're canceling both the Memorial Day ceremony and Independence Day celebrations, redirecting funds to a project for fallen residents. The mayor of Hod Hasharon said something that stuck with me. No one can say what the situation will be on Independence Day. The local government center, which represents municipalities nationally, recommended postponing large-scale events. And the music and entertainment industry is warning of tens of millions of shekels in losses, which follows earlier disruptions to Purim events. So this is hitting economically as well.
The timing is almost brutal. Yom HaZikaron is already the most emotionally heavy day on the Israeli calendar. It's the day you mourn the fallen before you celebrate independence. And this year, the ceasefire expires on that exact day. The day before you're supposed to celebrate national survival, you find out whether the war is resuming.
That collision is not coincidental, and I suspect it's not lost on Israeli planners. The symbolic weight of what happens on April 21st and 22nd is enormous. If fighting resumes on Yom HaZikaron, the political and emotional resonance of that timing will be felt for years. If a deal is somehow reached before then, Netanyahu can point to Independence Day as the moment Israel secured something historic. The calendar is doing a lot of work here.
There's also something to be said about the democratic tension in all of this. The IDF leaks operational readiness to signal deterrence. Netanyahu gives a televised address saying the campaign is not yet over. But the actual decision, whether to resume strikes, whether to accept terms, whether to let the ceasefire expire without a deal, that's happening in a very small room. Ordinary Israelis are making plans or canceling them, without any real information about what's coming.
And that's a tension Zamir has been explicit about. His surprise war doctrine specifically emphasizes civilian resilience as a strategic asset. The idea is that if the civilian population can sustain operations, economically, psychologically, logistically, the military has more operational freedom. But civilian resilience requires a certain level of trust in the government's management of information. When people are reading about IDF readiness in WinNet because it was deliberately leaked, rather than getting any kind of official communication, that trust gets complicated.
There's also the foiled terror plot in Haifa this morning. 10 kilograms of explosives, a plot to assassinate former Prime Minister Bennett, Iran linked. That's a reminder that the threat isn't only about ballistic missiles.
The sub-threshold stuff is actually where Iran has historically been most dangerous. And with their conventional missile capability degraded by 70%, the pressure to use other tools, terror networks, proxy harassment, asymmetric naval action, goes up. The Strait of Hormuz mine's concern is real. One major oil tanker hit by a mine creates a global market shock that Iran can point to as leverage without technically resuming direct hostilities.
What about the Lebanon front? Because the ceasefire with Iran explicitly excludes Lebanon, and Israel launched its largest wave of strikes in Lebanon on the same day the ceasefire took effect.
The Lebanon situation is a live conflict running in parallel. The IDF is operating in Bint Jebel right now, with commanders saying full operational control will be achieved within days. Hezbollah is still firing rockets into northern Israel. More than 1 million people have been displaced in Lebanon. And critically, the IRGC has threatened a regret-inducing response. If Israeli strikes on Lebanon, don't stop. So Iran has a hook. They can frame any resumption of hostilities as a response to Lebanon rather than a violation of the ceasefire, which gives them some diplomatic cover.
And then Turkey decides today is a good day to warn that they might be next on Israel's list.
Hakan Fidan's statement is worth taking seriously, not because a direct Israel-Turkey military conflict is imminent, but because it signals where regional alignments are hardening. Fidan called the Greece, Cyprus, Israel trilateral alliance a source of distrust, problems, and war. He labeled Israeli airstrikes in Syria a serious risk to Turkish national security. Turkey has been positioning itself as a potential mediator, but statements like this suggest that window may be closing. And if Turkey moves from rhetorical opposition to active support for Iran's diplomatic position, that changes the regional calculus.
Meanwhile, the UK is explicitly not supporting the naval blockade. Keir Starmer said so directly. So the coalition that launched this operation is already fracturing at the seams.
The US-Israel coordination is described as maximal, between Trump and Netanyahu, between the militaries, between intelligence services. But beyond that core bilateral relationship, the coalition is thin. And a naval blockade of Iranian ports in the Strait of Hormuz affects global shipping in ways that make European partners deeply uncomfortable. The UK's position is partly about the economic exposure of British shipping interests. This isn't purely principled opposition.
Let's talk about what the IDF is actually preparing for, mechanically. Because maximum readiness is a phrase that can mean a lot of things. What does the readiness posture described in the leak actually tell us about what the IDF expects?
The specific elements are revealing. Expanding the target bank in Iran, focused on missile systems and launchers. That's offensive planning, not defensive. Assembling large-scale strike packages combining deep strike capability, precision, and operational continuity. That's planning for a sustained campaign, not a one-night response. Rehearsing opening scenarios and ensuring swift transition from planning to execution. That's the kind of language you use when you want to be able to move within hours of a decision, not days. And reinforcing air defense deployment while preparing for multi-front escalation. That's the defensive layer that protects the ability to sustain offensive operations.
So the picture is, if Netanyahu and the cabinet decide to resume, the IDF can move fast.
Very fast. The shortening of response times is a specific operational directive, and the framing from the anonymous sources is careful. No decision has been made. But that phrase is doing a lot of work. It's technically true while also conveying that all the prerequisites for a decision have been met. The decision is the only thing that hasn't happened yet.
What would the trigger be? What would actually cause the decision to be made?
There are a few plausible triggers. First, a provocation from Iran, a missile attack, a proxy attack, something that gives Israel and the U.S. a justification to resume. Second, the ceasefire simply expiring on April 21st without a deal, which at this point looks likely. Third, intelligence indicating an imminent Iranian action, which given the state of IDF and U.S. intelligence coordination would probably be detected early. And fourth, a diplomatic development that actually creates space for a deal, which would be the outcome that avoids resumption. Right now, that fourth option looks the least likely.
The China dimension is worth flagging here, too. U.S. intelligence is reporting that China is preparing to ship advanced air defense systems to Iran. If that actually happens before any resumed fighting, it materially changes the cost of an Israeli strike campaign.
It's the kind of development that would accelerate Israeli and U.S. timelines rather than delay them. If Iran acquires Chinese air defense systems, the window for effective strikes narrows. That creates pressure to act before the systems arrive and are integrated. It's a classic preemption logic. The threat of a capability arriving creates urgency to strike before it does. And it's exactly the kind of intelligence that a chief of staff focused on never being surprised again would treat as a forcing function.
There's something almost vertiginous about all of this from the perspective of an ordinary Israeli. You have an IDF that is, by its own account, ready to flip a switch. You have a ceasefire expiring on Memorial Day. You have cities canceling Independence Day. You have a terror plot foiled in Haifa this morning. You have a naval blockade taking effect today. And the information you're getting is either a deliberate leak designed to signal something, or a televised address that says there is still work to do, without telling you what that work is or when it happens.
The JNS feature from April 10th captured this well. A doctor at Carmel Medical Center in Haifa said, "Whoever doesn't live here can't understand how complicated it is to maintain a routine in this chaos." That's not a political statement. That's a description of a cognitive and logistical reality. You're trying to run a hospital or plan a concert or decide whether to take your kids to a park, and the background condition of your life is that you don't know if there will be missiles next week.
And the economic ripple is real. The music and entertainment industry is already warning of tens of millions of shekels in losses from the Independence Day cancellations, following earlier Purim disruptions. These are not abstract numbers. These are performers, technical crews, drivers, vendors. The war economy has costs that don't show up in the military briefings.
Zamir's civilian resilience doctrine actually speaks to this directly, which is interesting. The argument is that civilian economic and psychological resilience is a strategic variable, not just a humanitarian concern. If the home front fractures, economically, psychologically, the military loses operational freedom because the government loses political support for continued operations. So, the IDF has a genuine institutional interest in the home front holding together. Whether the current information environment is serving that interest is a real question.
Because there's an argument that the deliberate leak, while useful for deterrent signaling to Iran, also amplifies anxiety at home in a way that undermines the resilience you're trying to build.
It's a genuine tension. You can't have a maximally transparent deterrent signal that is simultaneously a maximally reassuring domestic communication. The message "we are ready to strike" lands differently depending on whether you're in Tehran or Tel Aviv, and the Hebrew press is read by both audiences.
What's your read on where this lands? Not a prediction, but what does the decision tree actually look like from here?
The most likely path in the next 10 days is that the ceasefire expires without a deal. There's a period of maximum tension around April 21st and 22nd, and then either Iran does something that triggers a response, or Israel and the U.S. make a decision to resume on their own timeline. The Islamabad talks failing after 21 hours is a significant data point. If 21 hours couldn't produce an agreement, it's hard to see what changes in the next 8 days. Pakistan's defense minister said there's still a chance to restart negotiations, but that's the kind of statement you make when you don't have anything concrete.
The Saudi source suggesting a ground invasion may be necessary is a striking data point, too. Saudi Arabia has been a quiet partner in this operation. If they're signaling that view, it suggests the regional consensus is that air power alone won't resolve the uranium question.
And that circles back to Netanyahu's Saturday night address. There is still enriched material in Iran. It needs to be removed, either by agreement or it will come out in other ways. The ground invasion framing is one version of other ways. but the Israeli official who said it's impossible to seize the uranium by force was making a point about capability, not just will. Even a ground operation into the sites where the material is stored faces engineering and logistics challenges that the U.S. military hasn't solved. This is genuinely hard.
So the other ways might mean something more like a negotiated handover under maximum military pressure. You keep bombing until Iran decides giving up the uranium is better than continuing to absorb strikes.
That's the coercive diplomacy model, and it's essentially what the naval blockade is designed to support. You increase economic and military pressure to the point where the cost of holding onto the uranium exceeds the cost of surrendering it. The blockade adds an economic chokehold on top of the military degradation. Whether Iran's leadership, which has tied its domestic legitimacy to nuclear capability for 2 decades, can politically survive surrendering, it is a separate question.
And that's the question that no amount of IDF readiness can answer.
Military readiness creates options. It doesn't create outcomes. The IDF can be ready to flip the switch in hours. But whether that switch gets flipped and what the world looks like afterward depends on decisions being made in Washington and Jerusalem and Tehran that no amount of strike package assembly can predetermine.
All right, let me try to pull out the practical takeaways here, because this episode is dense. What should listeners actually be tracking in the next week?
3 things. First, whether there's any diplomatic movement before April 21st, Pakistan's offer to restart talks, any back-channel signals from Tehran. If nothing emerges by around April 18th or 19th, the ceasefire expiry without a deal is essentially locked in. Second, watch the naval blockade. Iran's response to the blockade, whether they challenge it, whether there are incidents in the strait, will tell you a lot about their risk tolerance right now. And third, watch Israeli municipal decisions about Independence Day. It sounds like a domestic cultural story, but it's actually a real-time barometer of what the Israeli government is communicating to local leaders about the security assessment for April 22nd.
And the China air defense system shipment is worth watching too, because if that materializes, it compresses the decision timeline significantly.
The intelligence on that is preliminary, but the IDF and U.S. intelligence services will be watching it closely. Any movement on that shipment could be the forcing function that accelerates a decision.
One last thing I want to flag, because I think it's the thread that ties everything together. Zamir's surprise war doctrine is explicitly a response to October 7th. The entire posture, the maximum readiness, the multi-front planning, the emphasis on shortening response times, the civilian resilience framework, is built on the lesson that Israel cannot afford to be surprised again. But there's an irony in that. The IDF is now in a position where it is the potential initiator of the next phase of this conflict. The surprise war doctrine was designed for a defensive scenario. The current posture is offensive planning. Those are different problems.
It's a real doctrinal tension. Preparing for a surprise attack and preparing to launch a strike campaign require overlapping but distinct capabilities and mindsets. Zamir has been trying to build both simultaneously, which is why the recent large-scale divisional exercises tested command and control, rapid maneuver, combined arms operations, and logistics under multi-domain conditions. You're training for the scenario where you're responding to something unexpected, and the scenario where you're initiating something planned. The hope is that the same level of readiness serves both. But the psychological and decision-making cultures around offensive initiation and defensive response are genuinely different.
And the ceasefire window is, in a way, the test of whether that dual readiness actually works, whether the IDF can stay at maximum alert through a period of uncertainty without either being caught off guard or triggering the very escalation it's trying to prevent.
That's the needle they're trying to thread right now, and the next 8 days will tell us a lot about whether they can do it.
Thanks as always to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping this operation running, and big thanks to Modal for the GPU credits that make this show possible. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to follow along as this situation develops, search for My Weird Prompts on Telegram to get notified when new episodes drop. Stay sharp out there.
Take care, everyone.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where our thoughts go from slow takes to facts on cue. We change and fall.